I'm Peter Marks, drama critic of The Washington Post.
I'm Elizabeth Fincantelli. I write about theater for The New York Times, The New Yorker, and Newsday.
And I'm Terry Teachout, drama critic of The Wall Street Journal. Welcome to the fourth episode of Three on the Isle, a podcast from New York about theater in America.
We're hosted by American Theater Magazine, a publication of the Theater Communications Group.
Peter and I are speaking to you from glamorous 8th Avenue in New York City.
And I'm in West Palm Beach, Florida, where Palm Beach Drama Works is presenting the world premiere of my second play, Billy and Me.
Yay!
Yeah, now that 2017 is drawing to a close, the three of us feel like thinking out loud about what we saw on stage in the year just past, what we liked, what it meant, as well as what we'd like to see in 2018. So I thought we might get started by spending a few minutes thinking out loud about the trends that we saw, or think we saw, in 2017. Between the three of us, I'd say we must have seen at least 200 different plays and musicals. What did all that theater add up to for you, Elizabeth? Can you see a thread that ran through it?
Well, I would say one thread is something we discussed in a previous podcast, and it's how to make political theater and how hard it is. I would say there were three shows that tried to tackle the Trump era just head on, and they were the Shakespeare in the Park production of Julius Caesar this summer, with Julius Caesar as a very visible alter ego of Donald Trump. Then there was Building the Wall, the Robert Schenken play, and I would say the third one, at least I'm talking about New York City here, was the Michael Moore show, The Terms of My Surrender. And I think all three of them were failures.
Ugh.
None of these three shows worked.
And then more recently, of course, Bo Willimon's play, The Parisian Woman,
right,
which
yes.
has Trump sort of tacked on to the top of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And I think these shows don't work because they're just
two on
bad
the nose.
Concepts.
Two on the
exactly,
nose.
Two on the nose. For me, the political shows that work are the ones that make a statement that is not overtly political, but that presents values that are antithetical to what the Trump administration is about. For instance, one of my favorite shows this year was a musical called K-pop. And K-pop is very matter-of-factly about just openness to others and how to deal with identity. But it wraps it in a very glittery, fun package. And it's just, I think it's afterwards that you think, huh, this is what this show is doing. And I think the best political shows are the ones that make you think on the subway back,
yes.
not hit you over the head while you're in your seat. And I think there's even a show that we'll discuss a little bit later, Mary Jane, for me, says things about empathy and patience and kindness and openness and, you know, in a kind of roundabout way, our healthcare system. But again, it's not about that openly. It's not, you know, Edna is bad.
Peter, is that what you think of when you think of political theater?
Well, that's what I was going to say. You know, there is a sort of something that says that every play in one way or another has to be political. I think that I saw a lot of theater this year that sort of reminded me of values that I hold dear that felt to me political in one way or another. And I felt some of those plays that Elizabeth mentioned were just kind of the theater of futility, that, you know, this kind of this raging voice that sort of is erupting that basically means that the choir all sort of like assents to. We all sort of go shake our heads and we go, yes, that's what we all think. And it ultimately feels kind of impotent. It doesn't really tell us anything new about the world. And that's what we go to the theater for. So no, and I'm going to talk in a little bit about a play that I thought much better represented the politics of the times. And we talk about some of our favorite plays of the year. But what do you think about that, Terry?
Well, to me, theater that works is, it's many things, but one thing it always is theater that surprises. And I just don't see how Preaching to the Choir can ever be surprising.
Mm-hmm.
You see it coming halfway down the track, you're tied
right.
to the track, you know, you're giving up a fundamental value of theater when you do something that is self-evident and predictable and that everybody knows how it's going to work out. No matter how sincerely you may feel about Trump or whatever it is that you're complaining about, this is not the way to make a show that excites and involves. And I think we've seen a lot of evidence of that in 2017. What other trend, Peter, are you seeing or have you seen in this past year? Anything that stands out?
I mean, in some ways, I'm very heartened by some of the theater I saw this year, particularly by women. And I think this may have been a sea change year for many reasons. And we've talked about some of those issues that have come to the fore. I also think I'm seeing, at least on the larger platforms of the theater, something that's kind of sad. I do think we're seeing the we can give an elegy for the commercial American play. I think that it's the big play on a big stage is dead in the water. And I don't mean it's that there isn't a lot of imagination out there by playwrights. I just think the audience for it has dried up, and the crashing and burning of A Doll's House Part II, a celebrated play on Broadway this year, universally, it's shut down right after 3 months, really says to me where we are as a culture in terms of.
I didn't care for that play at all, and I think I wouldn't say it crashed and burned. I mean, it was extended. It was a fairly.
No, it was. It was supposed to extend to the new year, Elizabeth, and it didn't. Right. And it was pretty much widely received as a major play. All I'm saying is that in this environment, you probably can't mount a serious play on Broadway without without a star, and even then, it's very difficult.
Ah, but you just put your finger on it when you said on Broadway.
True.
Right.
But I'm saying, I'm talking specifically about commercial ventures. I'm not talking about nonprofit plays. I think that's a very healthy sector. I'm talking about the play that a playwright wrote thinking, I'm going to make some money writing this play for a commercial audience by a commercial producer. I think that model is dead.
Yes.
Or pretty much dead. And I saw that this year in high relief.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. But there is, I think, another model by which playwrights can not make a killing, but maybe can make a living. And that is to produce a flow of small-scale work, practical in terms of cast requirements, attractive in terms of subject matter, that regional theaters are able to take up in large numbers. And the example there is Lauren Gunderson, a playwright who is all but unknown in New York and yet is the most widely performed playwright in America. That's a different way of doing this. But if you're talking about what I think, Peter, you might call the Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf model of success on Broadway, that's over.
Right, right.
I'm not sure. I'm going to try to stay positive. I mean, the American musical was left for dead, during the Great British Invasion of Andrew Lloyd Webber et al. And people were like, yeah, it's dead. We'll never get another Sondheim. And I think this has been proven wrong.
I do think, I'm sorry, I didn't mean you. Please continue.
I
would say that the difference is that on Broadway today, the audience is 70% tourists and growing. They're pushing out. You know, in the days when that happened, there was still a New York theater-going audience that could sustain a production.
They could afford to go. They could afford
and could
to
afford
go
to go.
Absolutely. Shows, yeah.
And today, it's. I mean, I do think that. But I appreciate that you're positive and think we can that we can change the cycle. I hope you're right.
No, I think it can still happen. It can still emerge at a place like the Public. It's not going to have the commercial run, but it could be sustaining further productions, all over the country. I think it is possible. I really want to believe that.
I think my feeling is it's 3 months and out. That's 3-4 months. That's going to be the model going forward for half. You want to see a play on Broadway with weird exceptions like Harry Potter and Curious Incident, which are spectacles and almost musicals in terms of their appeal. But they have a whole, and it should be said that both are by real playwrights. I do think that those are going to be, unfortunately, I still mourn this because I think that one of the great things about the theater is the variety. And if you even look ahead to this season and you see how many, brand extension shows are dominating the landscape in terms of galvanizing a larger audience. You're seeing, you know, how this is all shaping up and how it's crowding out the other
stuff. I would buy that. For me, the figure in the carpet became clear when I was working on my own best of 2017 list for the Wall Street Journal. I mean, I didn't have any trouble choosing a best musical. It was The Band's Visit.
Totally.
But remember, the premiere of that show actually took place off-Broadway in 2016 at the Atlantic Theater Company. It was a non-profit model. Of all the truly new musicals I reviewed last year, and not one of them struck me as anywhere close to first rate. I mean, not even Come From Away, which was the big sleeper hit, or War Paint, which, you know, starring roles for two big stars, Patti LuPone and Christine Ebersole. But what I saw instead was confirmation of a long-term trend that's been troubling me really for the greater part of the past decade, which is that the large-scale Broadway musical really seems to have run out of creative juice. It strikes me that the very well-deserved success of The Band's Visit is the success of a small-scale, small-house musical that isn't a natural fit for Broadway. And maybe that's a good thing, but I'm more inclined to think that it says something important about the poor health of the historic traditional musical. That's what I was seeing in this past year.
Well, I don't understand what you in one breath you say it's not The Band's Visit is not a natural fit on Broadway, and then in the next one you say it's doing very well. So clearly there's nothing like a natural fit on Broadway, because The Band's Visit is doing well. It is a sleeper hit like Come From Away, which is also, when it opened, was described as not a natural fit on Broadway. So we have two of the biggest, like, word of mouth, well, not just word of mouth, because they also got pretty good reviews, musicals that people thought, oh, it's not a natural fit on Broadway, and yet they're doing really well. I mean, they're not going to be Wicked, but they're doing very well, and I hope they recoup, and they're kind of hitting that sweet spot between artistic and commercial success. So I think it is possible, and I think we're in a
situation. You couldn't do them in a big theater. I mean, Come From Away and The Band's Visit are both being done in some of Broadway's more intimate houses.
So you're saying that there's no new My Fair Lady that will be playing?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying.
Terry, I saw Fun Home at the Public. I saw Fun Home at Circle in the Square, and I saw it at the National Theater in Washington in a 1,700-seat house, and it was the best version I'd seen, done on a large proscenium stage. It feels like one of those intimate musicals you're describing, and yet it didn't feel like a small musical when it was done on that. It was restaged a bit. I mean, they changed the set design a little bit to accommodate a proscenium. So I'm not so sure that we can... I'm with Elizabeth on this
one. And Fun Home is also not a natural fit on Broadway. It's had a very successful tour. I mean, of all musicals, I've got to say, honestly, I would not have put a better dime on a Fun Home tour.
Right.
And yet...
And it was, yeah, James Comey showed up backstage in Washington and took pictures with
nuts.
The cast.
Well, then maybe what we're seeing is that there's a lack of sync here. That... The older people writing musicals, thinking in terms of what a musical is, how you make it succeed, have lost touch. But maybe you have a new generation of people coming up with a nonprofit model in mind who are saying there are other ways to do this and we can make them work. That would be a very hopeful development.
And actually, David Yazbek, who wrote the score for The Band's Visit, he is also one who really bridges those worlds. Like Dirty Rotten Scoundrel is
yes,
a big show.
For Monty.
For Monty, they are big shows. The guy is very incredibly versatile. He can adapt to different sizes. He can adapt to different idioms. The score that he wrote for The Band's Visit, I mean, that to me is, The Band's Visit is a sign that Broadway ears are a little bit more open, that maybe people... I think The Band's Visit shows that Broadway ears are more open than usual, than they're given credit for. And there's a tendency to just underestimate the audience intelligence, which, okay, we're not going to go there.
Right. Okay.
But at the same time, it can really pay to not do that.
Well, maybe we're seeing the leading edge then of the generational shift that should have happened a long time ago, and that is finally.
I would say Lin-Manuel Miranda was that generation shift. That's it. He's the guy.
Let's hope. Well, from bad or at least ambiguous news to unequivocally good, let's share our best of the year list, starting with the best new play of 2017. Okay, I know that Elizabeth shares my enthusiasm, and you do too, Peter, for Amy Herzog's Mary Jane, which originated at the Yale Rep and then transferred to New York's New York Theater Workshop off-Broadway, which is where Carrie Coon joined the cast. For those who haven't seen it, it's the story of a single mother with a severely disabled child who finds within herself the capacity for everyday heroism. I've never seen a more honest portrayal of the day-to-day demands of caregiving, or, frankly, on stage, a more touching tribute to a mother's love. I think it might actually be Amy Herzog's best play to date.
Mm-hmm.
Most definitely.
Totally.
A best play.
I know there was another play that also made an equally strong impression on you, Elizabeth.
Yes, it was actually a play that was not, it was new to New York. It was a Robert Lepage solo show that he wrote and directed called 887. It was at BAM, and to me it was just absolute perfection in terms of writing and staging and performance, in a bilingual performance in French and English. And Lepage is known as a director, but this show really brought together a lot of his personal history growing up in Quebec. But the direction was so inventive and wonderful. And there was an idea minute. There were moments when I really found myself thinking, this sense of wonder, like the words fail me, this sense of wonder that you so rarely get at the theater. And when it happens, you're thinking, there's no better place on earth. How this guy did that? How did he think of doing that? So simple, so elegant. He's been touring it for a few years. So if it ever comes near you, I would highly recommend it because it is a lesson in humanity, but also pure stagecraft.
Well, Elizabeth, that's real criticism. I'm sitting here in Florida wishing desperately that I'd seen this show.
Yeah,
exactly. It was incredible. Did you see it, Peter?
I didn't, but I have loved Lepage since the 90s when I saw him do The Seven Streams of the River Ota, which was a 7-hour show. It was one of the most extraordinary pieces I've ever seen, and I've traveled to Canada to see his stuff. So I'm dying to see it.
It's
actually,
it's just incredible. But yeah, he's been touring it on and off. You know, when he has a bit of time in his schedule, and so I highly recommend it if it's ever near you.
Peter, you've already hinted at your best play of the year.
Yes, I'm going to diverge. I'm going to diverge. I liked Oslo a lot, but I'm going to put in a word for a play I saw in West Virginia this summer, and it goes to something, and the reason I've switched is because of our discussion about politics earlier on. It's a play by a young Yale University graduate named Eleanor Burgess. She wrote a play called The Niceties, and I will just tell you that basically it's a surprising play set in a university professor's office between a liberal professor and a student of color, and their argument over a paper she writes challenging the whole assumption about slavery and the teaching of how it existed during the revolution, and it challenges everything this professor thinks. It's based on a real incident that ended with a professor's firing or leaving Yale University. The circumstances were very different, but it was surprising because it takes two people on the progressive side of the aisle and shows how they basically eat each other's lunch, and it felt to me fresh for that reason. It wasn't cant. It wasn't a diatribe. It was really trying to expose the fissures within on the left and how they don't see eye to eye on issues. And it really took it apart brilliantly. And I hope it's done all over the country.
Well, I think that's really important because theater is a monoculture, left of center. And if it can explore fissures within the monoculture itself, then there's hope for a kind of ideological excitement and unpredictability
totally.
That we're not seeing in the political theater we talked about earlier.
And it's interesting, you know, when we talk about this stuff, you know, theater critics, I think what gets us excited is is not necessarily seeing our values reaffirmed on a stage. We want them challenged. That's what, I don't know, that gets me excited when somebody basically upsets me.
Yeah.
You know, in the theater. Yeah. I like that. And I think there's, and I think that's got to be encouraged. I'm a little afraid, and going back to, I mean, we'll move on, but I'm a little afraid that theaters in this country are worried about upsetting their subscribers and their boards with material that's not going to advance the form in any way, either thematically or dramatically. So this is where I come down on this thing.
A very legitimate concern. And let us move on to musicals, although I doubt that you out there in the listening audience will be surprised to hear that all three of us love The Band's Visit. I think I can speak for all of us when I say it's been a long time since I was more deeply moved by a new musical or more encouraged by its commercial success.
And that, Terry, is I think we all agree that has a lot to do with Katrina Lenk, one of the stars of the show, who has replaced for me Ben Platt as the hero of Broadway at the moment. He's gone from Dear Evan Hansen. I'm now a Katrina.
I saw him in the audience at SpongeBob.
Oh, really? Wow, that's great. That's great. So I love the way you say SpongeBob. I could listen to you say it all day, Elizabeth. But Katrina Lenk, who made my list of the best performers of 2017. And so here performing an excerpt from the score of The Band's Visit. Here she is.
Let me tell you about Petah Tikva. Such a city, everybody loves it. Lots of fun, lots of art, lots of culture. That's Petah Tikva with a P. Where you are, this is not Petah Tikva. Such a city, nobody knows it. Not a fun, not a art, not a culture. This is Petah Tikva with a B.
Elizabeth, I know you spoke a moment ago about another musical, a very unconventional one that hasn't gotten nearly as much attention as The Band's Visit, at least not yet. Yeah, tell us more.
Yes, I had mentioned K-pop earlier. I love that show, and unfortunately, it had too short a run and played for pretty small audiences due to the immersive nature of the show. So I'm really bummed that not enough people saw it. I thought it was very inventive and fun pop music experience, which is something that does not happen very much in the musical theater world, that to me is very cut off from what happens in music around it. It is incredibly insular. It's living off models that were made like 50, 60 years ago, too much of the time. And that show really went against that. It's not perfect. It had some problems, but I love the fact that it had an all-Asian cast also. And it's a show about the Korean pop, K-pop factory system. But it was both a satire of it, an explanation of it. And it had some very smart things to say about the creation of the pop culture world that we live in. I love that show. And I hope that somehow, somewhere, it has another life. It has a really fun score by Helen Park and Max Vernon. I really wish, and now also wish it will be recorded. I could listen to those songs forever. It's just, I don't know what it says about me.
Well, no,
I don't want to know.
I'll tell you what I think is significant about K-pop. I've been hearing about it from my millennial friends, people who do not go out of their way to go to musicals or who.
Oh, you mean the show as opposed to the music?
Yeah, the show, the show itself, and that tells me that there's something interesting there.
Same thing with SpongeBob. I find that that's something that a generation is going to see. Go see SpongeBob. I think definitely.
Wait, what do you mean by that?
Oh, the kids are going in mass. I mean, I went the other night, and they were, you know, it was the millennials were hooting and screaming like it was the Beatles in my generation.
I guess it's their nostalgia.
Yeah, yes, there's a lot of enthusiasm at this show, both on stage and off.
Indeed.
It's very high energy.
Yes, exactly.
I really enjoyed it, by the way.
Yeah. I didn't understand. I am not a SpongeBob, you know, fan, so I couldn't join, although I thought it was really well
executed. I'm not either. I've never seen an entire episode.
That's amazing. Good. Well, that's great. They should use you in the ads, my God.
You mean SpongeBob? Like that's
SpongeBob. I love that. That should be a thing. Well, it should be a meme.
I think a French endorsement is usually seen as a kiss of death here.
That's a whole other subject.
Well, let's move back to performers. Peter, obviously you mentioned Katrina Lenk, but there's another actor who's prominent on your best of list.
Ugh. It's the year of Laurie Metcalf. Have you guys seen Lady Bird, the movie?
I sure have.
Not yet.
That is, that is Oscar stuff she does. In
Oh, you saw it, Terry?
Yes, I did.
Oh, yeah.
On my day off from my play, I went to see Lady Bird. That's how much I wanted to see it.
A man of the arts. Laurie Metcalf was led the cast of A Doll's House Part II playing Nora 25 years later. I can't remember what the time frame is. But it's her moment. It's well-deserved. She won the Tony for the performance and she's going to, I think she probably is the odds-on favorite to win probably Best Supporting Actress Oscar for her performance as Saoirse Ronan's mother in Lady Bird. And she's just, I think she sets the standard right now for stage acting. She's just shown to be so versatile, and there's just nothing I would rather see than her again on Broadway.
Yeah, Elizabeth, I know you're with me on Carrie Coon, but who else would you single out for praise this year?
Well, for me, there were a couple. Earlier this year, I just loved Harriet Walter. Dame Harriet Walter played Prospero in an all-female version of The Tempest at St. Anne's. And Harriet Walter has been very vocal about the fact that she had played pretty much all the major Shakespearean women, and what was left for her to do? So she did Prospero. Why not? In fact, that was her third apparition in an all-female Shakespeare, so she's really getting out there. She's an absolute gem. I would say she is British acting at its finest. And I'm not even sure what that means, British acting, but when I think of British acting, I think of her rather than, I don't know, some of the better known people. She's just an incredible performer and an incredible person. I was lucky to interview her, and she's just, she's fantastic. She has such a sharp mind. She thinks about what she does so much. It is such a pleasure to see her work, and yet her performance don't feel labored or overthought. There's a freshness to it that is just incredible, considering her stage experience. She really reaches that place.
Yeah, we must spend some time in a future episode talking about the British American actor conundrum.
Yes,
let's remember that.
We should note to self.
Totally.
Yes.
And I'm going to put in a quick note for another performer that just finished a run at St. Anne's. Denise Goff was in People, Places, and Things, and she will be back in town in January because she's playing Hannah in Angels in America.
I didn't realize that.
And if you have a chance to see Denise Goff, if you saw her in People, Places, and Things, where she played a manipulative addict.
An actress manipulative addict.
Yes, so it's a double.
Right.
Double threat.
Yeah.
She was absolutely wonderful. And to see her again in Angels in America, I think we're very, very lucky.
Wow. I saw my performer of the year on the road up in Massachusetts this past summer in Barrington Stage's revival of Stephen Sondheim's Company. Beautifully staged, I should say, by Julianne Boyd. Aaron Tveit played the enigmatic Bobby, everybody's best friend, and strong words here, I doubt there's been a better Bobby since Dean Jones left the original Broadway cast 47 years ago. Tveit is a real singer. He's a true tenor, brilliantly gleaming high notes, but he's also a top-notch actor. He gave us a Bobby who was a volatile mix of charm, reserve, and well-concealed fear. That was a performance that belonged on Broadway.
That's so great to hear, Terry, because I am a Aaron Tveit fan, and I do think there's something singularly appropriate about that actor playing Bobby. There is an ambiguity about him, a sexual ambiguity when you see him on the stage. He's very masculine, very male, and very good-looking, but yet something sort of mysterious, too. So that sounds really intriguing.
Yes, I think that's key to making Bobby work, and he just nailed it. Productions. Peter, you mentioned The Niceties, and I gather the production was just as impressive as the play to you.
It was wonderfully done. It was a small, intimate theater, but I'm going to bounce back and just mention the production I thought that was, you know, the really singular one, which was Bartlett Shear's Oslo, which I thought had just the right touches of Stoppard and David Hare. It felt like a real kind of one of those great English political plays that they do so well. And I thought he staged it in the Vivian Beaumont just magnificently, very simply. The use in that case of projections really became the scenery, and in a way that didn't feel cliched. And he drew out the performances he got out of a range of actors. And that's one of the wonderful things about Oslo. It's a big play with a lot of characters. I don't know, 30 characters played by maybe 15, 16, 17 actors. I thought that was the highlight production of the season.
I think of this play as no slow. Or so slow. Or just...
Put a dagger in my heart, Elizabeth.
I just couldn't stand that play.
You're killing me.
Oh, God.
Elizabeth,
I'm killing you with bad puns.
Yeah. You really like this.
Oh, my God, that play.
All right, I want you to behave now. Is that clear?
Schoolhouse Rock Theater. Jesus, it was so... Let me tell you what happened. Oh, God.
Oh,
okay. All
you're
right.
You're killing
right,
me.
Let's straighten up and fly right here.
JT Rogers, close your ears. Don't listen to this this edition.
Elizabeth, I know that you were really impressed by the staging of 887, but there are a couple of other productions I'm thinking you're wanting to mention.
Right. A revival of Eugene O'Neill's The Hairy Ape. Took over the Park Avenue Armory Drill Hall, which is a gigantic space. I think it's the biggest in New York City, just in terms of sheer volume. And it was a completely nutty, over-the-top production starring Bobby Cannavale, who was in fine form. Also, in a completely different type, much smaller, I love the Sweeney Todd revival. At Barrow Street. No, no. Okay,
I didn't
so
get to see it.
Just me on that one. I would say it's my favorite production of that
Go
show.
Go for the pies. Go for the meat
oh,
pies.
Oh, no, they're not even real ones.
Well, what are they then?
That's about it.
They're more like shepherd's pies.
Yeah.
They're not real British pies. So I object. And finally, I want to put in a word for a wonderful little show that was staged actually in an acting school studio. And the show is called The Workshop, and it's about a writing workshop.
Oh, good heavens.
It's by Tori Townsend, and it starred Austin Pendleton as a kind of has-been, or more likely like a more like a never-been playwright who lords it over like MFA students. And it was incredibly funny and vicious, but also had a nice little heart underneath that. It was... I want to see more of that of Tori Townsend. That was incredibly promising. Austin Pendleton's best performance in years, and he's always good. But this finally also a chance to see him center stage as opposed to being a just a great part of an ensemble. It was at first I thought it would be a satire of all the the writing, the creative writing factory mills, like producing, unleashing onto the world all those just hapless writers saddled with debt.
Right, or like that Teresa Riebeck play, Seminar, yeah.
Yeah, but that was a much better version of it. But actually, it turned out to be not quite about that. It turned out to be really about what happens to a playwright that never quite made it and just lives on it and now teaches. Who teaches? Oh, my God. It was just incredibly depressing.
Just what we need.
This is what we need.
Well, once again, my production of the year was one that I saw at a regional theater, this time at Wisconsin's American Players Theater, which is a major classical festival. It was directed by Eric Tucker, who in this town is best known, and rightly so, as the founder of Bedlam Theater Company, which just did a new off-Broadway version of Peter Pan. But this summer, Tucker went out to Wisconsin, set up shop, and APT's newly renovated 1,100-seat outdoor amphitheater. I've never seen a large-scale production by him, but he's got that knock, too. He took Shakespeare's Pericles, which is not an easy nut to crack, and he turned it into a crowd-pleaser. Earthy, fanciful, unabashedly absurd, divinely poetic, all these things. It was like an explosion of joy right there on the stage, and when it was done, I wanted to see it all over again, right there and there, right then and there. I don't think there's any better test of a production than that.
Well, when you say crowd pleasing Pericles, right there.
I know. Doesn't it sound impossible, an oxymoron? But it's not. When it's in the hands of somebody that imaginative.
You know, I always say there's no problem plays. There's only plays that cannot be solved by good directors. So
yeah, I saw Mary Zimmerman do Pericles, and I thought it was fabulous. So
let's go around the horn to wrap things up with the answer to this question. Looking forward, what is at the top of your wish list for 2018? What would you like to see on an American stage that you've never seen before, or in your case, Elizabeth, that you're not seeing enough of? Tell us about it.
Well, if we're talking about revivals of plays, a lot of the state plays seem to be in rotation. And next year is going to have a lot of gay themed plays. The Boys in the Band is coming back. Just in America.
And it's his Broadway debut.
There's quite, you know, we just had Torch Song. I want someone to do the Children's Hour. I want someone to do Lillian Hellman.
Amen.
We had the Little Foxes this year. But I want someone to do that play. And it's another one that's very often called a problem play because the subject matter is, you know, thorny. Let's say it's thorny. But I think it can be done and done well. There was a production in London a few years ago with Keira Knightley and Elizabeth Moss that was rumored to come to Broadway, and it didn't happen, I think, for scheduling issues. But I want someone to do that play and do it well.
That's a good one.
It's got to be done non-commercially because of the size of the cast. But I think that play still flies. I really do.
And I think Hellman is made for this moment. I think you're absolutely
right.
She
really is. Her jaundiced eye. Talk about political theater. The Little Foxes is a political play.
I wish that Hellman had written The Parisian Woman.
Oh my God. Wow.
That would have been a better fit.
God, yeah, yes, absolutely.
I actually saw Foxes right when I came down here to West Palm Beach at Palm Beach Drama Works. And it was a very good production, but more than that, it was the right play for the right moment, and you could hear it land with that audience, especially the last scene. It was something. Peter, what do you want from Santa Claus?
Well, since you've asked that way, Mr. Teachout, I'm going to say what I'm wishing, and I send this wish out to the boards of theaters across the country and to the headhunters in the artistic field across the country. Find us a new generation of exciting artistic directors from a variety of backgrounds.
Yes.
Amen.
Let's
yes.
look across. There are something like 24 openings at regional theaters. It's a sea change moment. Let's have some. Let's throw the windows open on the theater. Bring in young artistic directors, bring in artistic directors of color, bring in women. Let's open this world up.
I'm for it.
I absolutely 100%, 150% second that. It's a really good moment. You're right. There's so many open positions right now. That almost never happens, but this could be a sea change. We'll see where this is going to go.
Especially as the culture is being forced into a major shift because of sexual harassment. If they don't seize on this moment, they've got no excuse. No excuse.
Indeed.
Well, I will be a stodgy, old-fashioned conservative type and mention an older play, like about the same vintage as The Children's Hour, that I have never seen on stage. It's called The Voice of the Turtle. It's by John Van Druten, who was one of England's most popular playwrights and Broadway in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. It's a three-hander about a soldier and two not-so-innocent young actresses. It opened on Broadway in 1943. It ran for 4 years and 1,557 performances. 6 decades later, it is still the 8th longest-running play in the history of Broadway, but it has never been revived there, and I don't see why not. Yes, it's a period piece. It's an old-fashioned, well-made comedy. But on paper, it's still got that youthful glow, and I myself would travel a long way to find out how well The Voice of the Turtle plays in the theater, but not today. The clock says we're out of here. We hope to offer you another podcast next month full of interesting talk and challenging ideas. Until then, I'm Terry Teachout.
I'm Elizabeth Vincentelli.
I'm Peter Marks, and you've been listening to Three on the Isle, a podcast from New York about theater in America, hosted by American Theater Magazine.
Our producer is Kirby Pate.
You can follow us on Twitter at 3 on the aisle, that's T-H-R-E-E on the aisle, and write to us at 3ontheaisle@gmail.com.
Let us know what you think and what you'd like to hear on future podcasts.
Thanks for joining us. We'll see you on the aisle.